All right, hello everyone. Welcome to this third panel. It's an enormous pleasure to see you all here. My name is Will Jones. I'll be moderating this session. I'm a departmental lecturer at the Refugee Studies Centre in the Politics of Forced Migration. I will be talking as little as possible for the rest of this. So two small bits of housekeeping. So for some of our speeches, there are things which is going to get handed out. So I'm relying on you all as wonderful people to make that process go as seamlessly as possible when a pile is handed to you to take one and pass it on. I'm sure we're all going to do it brilliantly. And I'm going to do Q&A all at the end rather than between talks, because I've been told to be militant about timing. So if you see me waving a red thing, that's what's happened. I'll introduce speakers as we go. Suffice to say, it's a fascinating panel and a really precious opportunity to have so many different voices on the issue of promoting safe routes. What we're moving to now is Anne-Laure Loiseau and Gracie Alras, who are the co-founders of Série Un Visa Une Vie, and I understand that this presentation is at least partially in French, but there is a translation which should be making its way around to all of you. Has this happened successfully? Wonderful. I'll do the PowerPoint now then for you. One moment.
Thank you very much for inviting us to this fantastic conference indeed. Série Un Visa Une Vie is an action carried on by a small group of Belgian citizens. In 2015, everyone has been deeply moved, touched by the picture of the little island Kurdi, found dead on a Turkish coast. For me, there was another picture. At the beginning of 2015, on January the 7th, at a few thousand kilometers from Belgium, from Brussels, a little Syrian boy was found frozen to death in a camp in Lebanon. And this picture was really, I don't know why, but it was really for me a tipping point. It made me decide to act and to try to do something. And beside this dramatic picture, I would soon have in my mind these two other pictures of two Syrian girls, Aifa and Marwa, 4 and 5 years old. So, okay, it was January 2015, and I contacted some friends and accountants, and I also tried to reach some people in Belgium who could be helping the Syrian population, because, as you know, at that time, no one or almost no one was talking about Syria around me or in the media. And that's when I met with Gazi Elhas, who is a pharmacist born in Syria, in Hama, and who settled in Belgium 40 years ago. And since the beginning of the war, he has been running a fantastic humanitarian action called Network of Supporting the Syrian People, and is sending and dispatching medicine, medical equipment, clothes and food to Syrian families in need on the ground. So we had our small group, and we had a first meeting just a few days after that. And at that time, in fact, a few refugees reached Europe. And we had already seen the dramatic drowning of Lampedusa without knowing, in fact, how horrible would be 2015 and 16. And as Belgian people, we had never had any trouble to travel abroad without a visa. And in fact, our discussions about the situation of the Syrian people, the Syrian civilians, made us realize what it means not to be allowed to cross a border, not to be allowed to just take a plane. And while in fact you are fleeing the most atrocities in your country. And so that's where we had this crazy idea of asking our government for humanitarian visas, for Syrian families. That was for us a way to help Syrian civilians with all means, at all level. It was quite crazy, but we thought, okay, they needed protection and they could receive it in Belgium, so it was worth trying. So, with the help of Ghazi Elhas and his contact in the hospital on the fields, where he is sending medicines and medical equipment, we received these two pictures of two little girls, and with each picture, a phone number in a camp, in a refugee camp at the border of Turkey. So in Syria, but at the border with Turkey, because of the bombing, these little girls with their families had to flee their home and had taken, had found a refuge. So at the border with Turkey in the camp. And so here you see one first camp, the camp where Haifa was, and the second one, the camp of Marwa. And this, the two families, they didn't know each other, but the point was they were they had been treated in the same hospital because Haifa. So Haifa, she has a very severe heart defect, and Marwa, the second girl. Oh, you don't see her anymore. Okay, no problem. She was hit at her leg in a bombing in her on her house, and so she cannot walk anymore. And this is how it all began, and we called our project Syrie en visa en vie. We only have a Facebook page, but it works. And everyone thought we were completely insane, because humanitarian visa is barely known in Belgium, and actually we had never seen these families for real. So, okay. But 5 months later, these two families arrived in Brussels at the airport by plane, so it worked. Haifa was operated at her heart almost directly after her arrival in Belgium. It was a very, very long and risky operation, but everything went well, and now she's out of danger. Marwa, she has just been operated of her leg, and she's recovering, but okay. And what we didn't know is that another child of the families was in fact in a more imminent danger, and it was Mustafa, the older brother of Marwa, because we did discover that he had a parasite in his brain, and the evasion was the size of a tennis ball. And so at the beginning of this year, he had to have a very delicate surgery, and is also out of danger. And in Syria, he would just have been dead without any chance of help. So these children, they needed doctors, but they also needed citizens fighting for them, because their parents, they didn't have the money to pay the mafia of the smugglers. And also because of these children, they were way too fragile to survive the perilous crossing of the sea. And so these families, they have no link with Belgium, and we decided to be the link. So in the visa applications, we took the engagement towards our state to take care of this family as if they were our own family. So we enclosed a copy of our ID cards. The dad sent us the picture of the medical reports on WhatsApp, and we had all the documents translated. We worked with specialized lawyers on the legal argumentation for granting the visas. And at the end, we collected all the money to pay the tax, the visa tax, it was very high, and also the flight tickets. And so in order to apply for the visas, the family had to reach an embassy, a Belgian embassy, and there is no Belgian embassy in Syria anymore. So they had to cross a border, and the nearest border was Turkey, but the border was closed. And the border guards, they were just shooting at the people trying to cross illegally. So they had to take this risk, and it was awful because we felt so responsible, but there was no other option for these children, so they had to do it. And we prayed day and night because we knew it would be happening that they would cross. And they had to stay for days in the mountains with their children, hiding for the guards without much food and trying to keep the children quiet. Marwa, she cannot walk. She had to do it alone with a smuggler. It was crazy, but they did it. They finally did it. And then we went to Turkey to meet them. So Gazi, it's the first picture we have with him, with the family. And it was very emotional because we had been working so long on their file, and we were finally meeting them. And also we were not sure that we would see them again because we didn't know how the authorities would react. So yeah, it was. So you see the fingers of Marwa. She has like drumsticks because of the lack of oxygen. It's Haifa, and she's totally blue. Here you have the leg of Marwa. She cannot walk anymore. And then we went to the embassy to support the file, and we did all the paperwork, and we explained to our embassy why these people had to receive humanitarian visas. And we left them. We gave them some money. We gave them some money to live in Turkey for a few months, and we went back. We went back to Belgium. And 11 days later, we got an email from our embassy saying that the visa had been granted. You see the laissez-passer, they had no passport. They even had any passport. So we had to do it with laissez-passer. And they could just take the plane with me. I went back to Turkey. And so we arrived in Brussels. There were lots of journalists. Because actually, without knowing it, we had done something new in Europe. So there were Italian people, Dutch people, German people. They were just curious about us. And basically, every group of citizens in Europe can do that because we didn't receive any political support. We just asked for the application of a legal possibility. So yes, we didn't ask for a favor. We just did it on the normal way. And why we did it? It's because we think it's completely absurd, and we cannot accept that in order to be able to get the protection they are entitled to as a refugee, the people fleeing the war have to risk their life and pay the mafia in order to put their feet on the European ground. That is completely absurd. And you know, the most vulnerable people, the poorest, people who are sick, wounded, they are still in Syria under the bombs or starving to death. And so Gazi will talk a bit about what we have been doing since then, like family reunifications and helping with settling and all the things we could do with the refugees who arrived by their own means, that means illegally. And we are also working with academics, just to end, to find and promote other ways to get visas for refugees, and in particular visas for students, so you can do that too, and private sponsorship programs. Because there are many, many ways to protect refugees, And in fact, I want to be able to tell my children when they grow up that I search for them.
Merci beaucoup pour tous et tous ceux qui sont présents. Merci pour les organisateurs qui nous ont permis de parler des souffrances des familles syriennes. Je m'appelle Elras Ghazi, je suis pharmacien d'origine syrienne. Depuis 45 ans en Belgique. Quand les événements ont commencé en Syrie, je me suis engagé pour aider les familles et surtout les femmes et les enfants qui sont déplacés à l'intérieur de la Syrie. Il n'y avait pas encore le problème de réfugiés beaucoup en Europe au début. Ça, c'est un peu récent, depuis 2 ans que ça a commencé. J'ai formé une association et une chaîne logistique à partir de Bruxelles jusqu'à la Syrie. Avec le soutien de ma femme Al-Afel Azar, qui est ici présente, et puis 2 jeunes filles universitaires, nous avons pu réaliser une chaîne logistique. Et donc, il y avait plusieurs pays européens qui nous envoient de l'aide et que nous avons centralisé à Bruxelles et acheminons vers la Syrie. J'étais 2 fois au Parlement belge pour parler des blessés qui sont en Syrie, donc il y avait en quelque sorte un embargo par la communauté internationale. Je voulais vraiment aider les blessés qui sont là-bas. Je suis allé 4 fois en Syrie au début des événements. J'ai vu comment ils transportaient les blessés et comment les blessés arrivaient à la frontière. Ils sont là, en train de saigner. Il y en a qui sont décédés sur le chemin. Il y en a à qui on a amputé des jambes ou des bras, parce qu'ils sont arrivés en retard à l'hôpital pour recevoir les soins élémentaires. Excusez-moi si je parle un peu vite, c'est pour qu'il n'y ait pas pour le temps, parce qu'on m'a dit que c'est limité. Et donc, en revenant après 3-4 voyages, j'ai constitué un sac d'urgence pour les blessés et qui était transportable facilement avec tout ce qui est nécessaire pour sauver un blessé et avec les médicaments et une liste qui est écrite en arabe pour que n'importe qui, infirmière ou même un étudiant, peut prendre soin d'un blessé en attendant qu'il arrive dans un hôpital en Turquie. C'était bien sûr dans les régions qu'on appelle libérées. Donc, ça c'est la première chose, et j'ai demandé au Parlement pour qu'on nous aide pour certains enfants ou femmes qui sont blessés là-bas et qui ont besoin d'urgence d'être soignés, mais il n'y avait pas de réponse ou de collaboration de la part des autorités belges. Ils m'ont aidé seulement pour nous acheter des médicaments. C'est déjà, on les remercie aussi beaucoup pour ça. Et donc au hasard, Madame Anlor vient au début de l'année 2015 chez moi me voir. Et nous avons fait très vite une réunion qui était une réunion extraordinaire. Pendant 2 heures, on a pris des décisions très concrètes pour choisir 2 familles dont il y a des enfants qui ont besoin des soins vraiment urgents. Et moi, j'ai pris le contact avec les médecins que je connaissais sur place pour choisir ces 2 familles. Et nous avons continué donc pendant 6 mois ces contacts jusqu'au moment où, bien sûr, nous sommes soutenus par des avocats qui sont bien informés de la situation et qui voulaient bien travailler avec nous pour aider ces familles bénévolement. Et donc, pendant 6 mois, nous avons travaillé. Quand c'était le moment, on a dit aux familles de traverser la frontière. C'était quelque chose de très, très dangereux parce que c'était clandestinement qu'ils devaient traverser. Nous étions pendant des nuits et des jours en train d'attendre pour voir le résultat de traverser, s'ils arrivent ou s'il y a des problèmes, ainsi de suite. Ils sont arrivés intacts, heureusement. Je suis allé à ce moment-là les recevoir, comme vous avez vu dans les photos. J'ai préparé des appartements pour eux, l'argent nécessaire, en attendant que nous avons aussi l'ordre des avocats pour qu'ils aillent déposer la demande de visa à Ankara. Quand nous avons reçu un peu moins qu'un mois l'ordre qu'ils peuvent aller à Ankara, ils sont allés là-bas. À ce moment-là, Madame Anlor a pris le relais et les a joints à Ankara deux fois, une fois pour déposer la demande, une fois pour les chercher. Maintenant, ici, le problème des réfugiés que nous sommes... Je ne vais pas parler beaucoup, développer de ce que Madame Anlor a bien cité pour vous, mais en fait, pour les réfugiés, nous avons travaillé pour les visas humanitaires, mais nous avons aussi travaillé pour les familles. Les familles qui doivent faire des regroupements familiaux. Le regroupement familial, c'est aussi un problème. C'est à peu près, peut-être moins grave, mais c'est aussi équivalent. Ça veut dire quoi? Il y avait des familles prisonnières sous les bombardements, il fallait les sauver. Nous avons intervenu auprès des ambassades pour accorder les visas le plus vite possible, bien sûr avec l'aide des avocats. Nous avons réussi plusieurs cas. Et nous avons aussi aidé les familles pour le regroupement, parce qu'il y avait le chef de famille qui était en Belgique, mais la famille est en Syrie. Alors il y a 4 ou 5 ou 6 enfants, et quelquefois il y en a même 7 avec la maman. Donc le monsieur, le chef de famille, n'a pas d'argent pour les faire venir. Donc il fallait trouver aussi une somme d'argent pour acheter les billets et auprès des ambassades, parce que ça coûte trop cher pour faire venir. Ça, c'est des cas qui sont arrivés. Mais il y a encore une autre chose. Ce n'est pas fini pour le réfugié. Parce que le réfugié aussi, quand il arrive en Belgique, il souffre. Il y en a beaucoup qui font des dépressions. Il faut aussi les aider. Ce travail que nous avons poursuivi avec les deux familles, on le poursuit aussi avec des autres familles. Donc, il faut les inscrire à l'école, à l'hôpital. Il faut trouver surtout au début le logement. Ce n'est pas une question de travail au début. Non, il faut trouver le logement. Quand il n'y a pas de logement, eh bien, la famille est dispersée. Il faut aussi les sortir des camps de réfugiés, parce qu'il y a plusieurs camps de camps, presque en Belgique, où les réfugiés souffrent énormément des conditions dont ils vivent. Et ces conditions sont vraiment terribles. Ils ne supportent pas, il y a des femmes et des enfants. Donc il faut les aider. Alors qu'est-ce qu'on fait? On va trouver des familles d'accueil pour accueillir ces réfugiés dans les centres, et puis les aider ensuite pour s'installer. Et je m'excuse si je m'arrête, mais il y a beaucoup de choses à dire. Il faut beaucoup aider les réfugiés, en tout cas, quand ils sortent, quand ils sont dans les centres et qu'ils arrivent en Belgique, pour toutes sortes. Merci beaucoup pour votre attention.
Thank you very much, Anne-Laure and Kazi. We now turn to Julia Gori, who is a project officer from the Refugees and Migrant Service Mediterranean Hope of the Federation of Protestant Churches in Italy.
Okay, good afternoon. So I'm here to tell you a bit more about our program on humanitarian corridors. So the idea of the project started 3 years ago, in 2013, exactly on the 3rd of October, when there was, very close to the Lampedusa Isle, a terrible shipwreck with 368 migrants who died in the attempt of reaching Europe. So after this terrible shipwreck, many others followed and are following. And this is due, as my colleague was telling before, to the fact that to access protection in Europe, an asylum seeker needs to be physically present in Europe. So the protection is very much linked, is dependent on the physical presence of the person who seeks protection. But for many, many refugees from African countries, from Afghanistan, from Syria, getting a visa to legally and safely enter Europe, it's very, very difficult, sometimes impossible. Again, in order to access the right to seek asylum, to seek protection, an asylum seeker need to risk their life. Crossing the Mediterranean, crossing the desert, which is another very dangerous route, before, again, crossing the sea. So, here I have some if we have a look to the numbers, to the statistics, from 1990 to last year, 26,000 migrants died, for what we know. And during this year, from January the 1st to now, well, actually, that number, 2,040 migrants, was... Well, I prepared this slide 2 weeks ago. Yesterday, before coming here, I was checking again on the internet, and I discovered that there are 400 migrants died, migrants more, so just in 2 weeks. So we, as a federation, we started to think that we really need to do something to show that another way was possible, is possible. There must be a way of accessing protection in safety and in dignity for these people. So a memorandum of understanding was signed in December of last year between our Ministry of Foreign Affairs, between our Ministry of Interior, the Federation of Protestant Churches, I work for the Federation, our partner, the community of Sant'Egidio, and the Valdensian, the Protestant Church, the Valdensian Church in Italy, who is funding all our program, all our humanitarian corridors, thanks to what we call in Italia 8 per mille. So maybe I should explain briefly what 8 per mille is. It's 8 per thousand. So basically, under Italian law, taxpayers can choose to whom devolve the 8 per thousand part of their annual income tax return. And they can choose between a number of religious confessions, but mainly, obviously, Catholic Church being in Italian, but also between Protestant Church, meaning Valdensian Church, Baptist Church, Lutheran Church, or other confession, or the state. So as the Valdensian Church uses completely what the 8 per mille funds for social projects and not for worship and pastoral work, it's very appreciated among Italian taxpayers. And what happened is that many taxpayers, even if not linked to Protestant church, decide to give their 8 per mille to the church, which is quite rich, actually. And it's funding, in our case, the total part of the total cost of our program. So the agreement was signed, allowed us 1,000 visa, humanitarian visa. So between this year and next year, in the next two years, humanitarian corridors we will allow for the arrival of 1,000 asylum seekers from three countries, from Lebanon, mainly Syrians, obviously, who fled the war and were seeking asylum in Lebanon in the refugee camps, from Morocco, but not obviously Moroccan, but people from sub-Saharan countries, and then from Ethiopia. And there will be mainly people from Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan. The beneficiary of our program are people in vulnerable conditions. So vulnerability is the requirement. It meaning minors, unaccompanied minors, women alone or with minors, or people with health problems. Why vulnerability? Because our program is based on Article 25 of the Visa Code, the EU Visa Regulation, which gives member states the possibility to issue visas with limited territorial validity, so just to enter the country, in my case Italy, for humanitarian reasons. The main aim of the corridors are obviously prevent refugees from traveling on death boats and prevent refugees from turning to human traffickers in order to access their right to seek protection, and allow people obviously in vulnerable condition to enter legally and safely Europe. The actor at stake. So this is interesting for many
what I want to see, I will show you, but the beneficiary are very, very, there are many controls on the people who arrive. And although I personally, me, but the statistics says that it's really, thinking that between the migration flows, there are people like terrorist crime or terrorist group. Me and the statistics show that it's really not it's not true, and it's ridiculous thinking that terrorists risk their life in that way to enter Europe. But this security issue and the control issue is very sensitive, and actually our beneficiaries are very much controlled, because many actors and many are at stake, and the process, I mean, the list of people are first check, okay, about our organization. After that, we produce a list of beneficiaries, and the Italian consular authorities in loco, in Lebanon, in Morocco, and in Ethiopia, check the names. After that, there is another check by the Ministry of the Interior. After that, there is a further check on the by the competent local authorities. So they are granted this visa, and when they enter Italy, they need to seek asylum, as every other asylum seeker. So there are other controls from the border police, and then they have to be personally heard by the territorial commission for the recognition of international asylum. So, as you see, many people, many subjects at stake, many subjects involved. Once in Italy, beneficiaries are also supported by our program in their integration program. So we run refugee centers, not paid by the government, but paid by our funds, by 8 per mille, as I told you. And our reception center try to reach the highest standard, meaning we provide for, obviously, material reception, like accommodation, food, clothing, public transport, linguistic mediation, healthcare, psychological support for adults and for minors. We provide intensive Italian language courses. Children are brought to school. We provide legal assistance, social assistance, public service orientation, career guidance, so scholarship programs, course. So we really try to help them to integrate as soon and as easily as possible in Italy. Okay, here, and I've done, there is a short video on the one of the arrival at Fiumicino Airport in Rome of these people. It was in May, last May. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Our final speaker in this panel is Christina Lehmann, who is a fundraising manager from the Migrant Offshore Aid Station.
First of all, like everyone else, I'd like to thank the organisers very much for asking us to be here and everybody who's participated so far. It's an absolute honour and a privilege to speak with all the speakers today, including the ones on this panel. I feel like a bit of a grim reaper because I think I'm here to give the other side of the story in terms of safe passage, because what we do at the Migrant Offshore Aid Station is provide for the people who are taking some of the most dangerous routes and who have no access at the moment to safe passage on a mass scale. So I'll try and be brief. What our organisation does, for those of you who don't know, is maritime search and rescue. We have two vessels. Yeah, we have two mothership big vessels like this, and each of those have two rescue launches on board, and we also operate humanitarian drones that do location and surveillance. And we literally do this process of search and rescue at sea. And the routes that we take depend on the needs of the beneficiary community, but it's always based on maritime search and rescue. So we operate on one of the world's deadliest migrant routes, which is the Mediterranean. It accounts for around 75% of the deaths or missing presumed dead that are reported, which is not the full picture. We completely understand. We don't know how many people are dead or missing presumed dead in the zones with no data collection, like national waters of Libya, and also, for example, the desert was already mentioned. Our suspicion is that numbers there are much, much higher than reported. So just looking at our route that we work on, at the moment we're in the central Mediterranean. We've worked in the Aegean and the Andaman before. Over 207,000 new arrivals just in 2016. And the deaths in the Mediterranean increase year on year, despite the fact that we are constantly talking about migration and everyone calls it the greatest humanitarian topic of our generation. We're still seeing increased deaths in the Mediterranean. And this year alone, 2,800 people have already died crossing, and this was before the beginning of June. I'll give you a case study. We went out into the central Mediterranean on the 8th of June because we were doing our transfer from our Aegean mission to our central Mediterranean mission, and our ships were in port getting maintenance. In 5 days at the end of May, there were over 1,000 people that died or are missing, presumed dead, just in the central Mediterranean region alone. During that period, over 13,000 people were rescued by European search and rescue organisations, both state and non-state. This shows that the Mediterranean is still being used as an extremely prevalent route into Europe and is one of the most dangerous. So you have one of the most dangerous routes being one of the most popular routes. Common threats that people face, I can only speak for maritime routes, but of course this extends far beyond on either side, are threats pre-embarkation, which include violence, exploitation, threat to life on the routes into the transit countries like Libya, like Turkey, and also, as many people have touched on, the fact that people are putting their lives into the hands of smugglers who only care about the bottom line and really don't care about the safety of their human cargo. Then at sea there are different risks, which include drowning, dehydration, hypothermia, asphyxiation, exposure, and post-disembarkation, even once people arrive in Europe, because the system is so opaque and organisations try to have a cohesive response, but because there is no, like, we don't do projects post-disembarkation, so we're relying then on a handover to other services, and they in turn hand over to other services. There are always people that get lost in the cracks. There are always criminal organisations that will exploit that fact, and so the vulnerability continues even into Europe post-disembarkation. Our motto is no one deserves to die at sea, because we do maritime search and rescue, but that could really read no one deserves to die, period. And the region where the migrant offshore aid station and not the refugee and asylum seeker offshore aid station is because, as was touched on in some of the earlier panels, there is no discrimination in the fact that everyone has the right to life. So regardless of their onward journey and regardless of people's the process beyond disembarkation, we would not be on our boat trying to assess asylum or a refugee status before we pick people out of the water. So it's a very indiscriminate process that we participate in. We've rescued on our vessels over 15,000 individuals so far. As I said, Andaman, Aegean and Central Mediterranean so far, but that's based on the needs of our beneficiaries. A case study for us, we started 8th of June this year. It's our third Central Mediterranean operation. In the first week we were at sea, we rescued over 1,500 people in collaboration with other actors, over 18 different operations, and on one day, the 11th of June, we did seven and rescued 750 people, and still we see people dying, and there are other organisations like ours out there. We're not alone. So why the promotion of safe routes? For us, we see three very clear delineated ideas of why we promote, why we would advocate for safe routes. There are the humanitarian, which we all feel very deeply, but also economic reasons and also reasons related to security and social inclusion. So the humanitarian benefits are the ones that we're all most familiar with and the ones that we find easiest to discuss. Of course, we would benefit from a decreased loss of life. We promoted safer routes. And not just the mitigation of loss of life, but also of exploitation of the most vulnerable in our community. So even if people don't lose their lives on the route, make no mistake that they're not arriving unscathed. So the fact that people have survived the journey is not an indication that they're not marked by the journey. Also, it would reduce the exploitation and violence that people experience en route, because the routes would be better monitored and therefore understood, and we would have actors from the international and national communities on each part of the route, rather than right now there are parts of the route that are very, very well documented and then parts of the route that we know almost nothing about, like, for example, through the desert and what was happening at sea before non-governmental organisations and private actors started to allow a little bit of a spotlight to enter the maritime routes. If we had the safe routes, like, for example, the humanitarian corridors that we discussed earlier, it also allows everyone equal access to it, rather than the most powerful or people that benefit from a higher economic status being able to access routes, whereas the most vulnerable of our communities are the ones left behind, as was touched on by everybody that spoke before me. Also, cohesion and transparency. So, like I said, we get to really assess the services being provided from start to finish, rather than all of us taking care of our own part of the journey and not really having a clear understanding of what happens on either side of our intervention. The economic benefits are perhaps something that's not as pretty to talk about, but also exist and are important for us to understand when we're talking to policymakers and lawmakers about the advocacy for humanitarian corridors and for other safe passage. So ad hoc is always more expensive than a planned and budgeted response. That's not only because you have all the information available to you and you can pick the best service providers, but also because you can then distribute those costs more effectively and ensure that all actors that want to intervene have a clear idea of what their own responsibilities are. So when we go out and see, we don't know if we're going to rescue 100 people or 1,000 people, and we don't know if the route is going to be very well used or not used at all. And when the routes shift very quickly, we don't always have access to that information in advance, which means that we lose efficacy in the provision of our service financially. Also, we would benefit, the host communities would also benefit from a more holistic response to passage provision, because temporary reception and integration services provided to people that are in transit, these things cost money and they often are a small part of the onward journey. So you end up investing in the journey itself, and if you could coordinate the journey and make it more cost effective, you could then invest that money in the country of final arrival on more comprehensive integration programs. And finally, of course, beneficiaries. This one is something that we don't talk about enough. It costs a lot of money to smuggle yourself from your country of origin to the European country where you plan to seek asylum. It means that even if you manage to raise enough money to get your family across borders, which is often impossible, but even if you do manage to do that, you're then left with no money, and it makes you more vulnerable upon arrival. You rely more on the host community then to provide you with all the services you need. Whereas if you had more of your own resources, you could then contribute to your own integration in a more collaborative way. Finally, security and social inclusion. My views on security are very similar to the previous speaker. The evidence doesn't support this idea that we have a lot of terrorists coming in on boats. That's not really supported by evidence, but the impression that that is happening is equally important, even if it isn't happening. The impression is that that is happening, and it makes integration and public interaction extremely difficult. So if we could better assess arrivals and control the flows, people would be more comfortable with that concept and allow social inclusion to happen a little bit more easily, and for our communities to interact by breaking down a few of the barriers that exist at the moment. Finally, I'll say that policies that have been implemented recently that are like clamping down on the more dangerous routes, they often use the fact that those routes are so dangerous and people are being exploited as a reason to clamp down on them. Yes, it's true, but if you don't provide people with an alternative, you're forcing them into still yet more vulnerable positions, and they take still more risky routes. There is not a single beneficiary that we have come across that is under any illusion about the danger that they are undertaking on the Mediterranean crossing. The literal translation of the boats that they get on is death boat. Everybody knows that they're taking their life into their own hands when they get on one of these vessels. So it's not a lack of understanding about the danger. So if you're going to clamp down on the dangerous routes and you're going to try and implement systems that don't benefit criminal communities, you have to provide an alternative, because if you don't, you're pushing it further underground and making it harder for service providers to access those beneficiary communities. We believe that safe and durable solutions from start to finish provide service providers with the opportunity to discuss with other service providers, be they state or non-state, and it benefits everyone on every portion of the journey from start to finish. So although we personally only take part in a very small section of the journey, which we're very aware of, if there was an increased planning and cohesive response, we would be more than willing and able to negotiate with other actors to expand our reach. So I'm honoured to have listened to some of the solutions that have been discussed so far. And us as an organisation, we're very, very aware that we're a band-aid, that we are not providing a solution, but that as long as people are dying, we have a responsibility to be present in the med. But yes, we're under no illusion that is one of the most deadly routes, and we look forward to a day that we are no longer necessary and that our maritime operations can stop and we can focus on other things.
I would like to thank Christina, and I'd like to thank all of our speakers for five incredibly rich presentations, and achieving the small miracle of giving us such rich presentations in time. So thank you all so much, which means we do have time now, quite a lot of time, for questions. Got quite a few, so I might take a round. Is that the most sensible? So if we take maybe three questions, and then people as and when they wish to respond may. Now, there was a very specific question about the Humanitarian Corridors Programme, so yes. why don't we start there?
Regarding to the countries where we work, so first reason is the ministry, well, the countries are a result of an agreement with the minister. So we mainly didn't choose, we choose partially because we have a very strong network in that country. But for instance, Morocco, that was the minister who chose and allowed us to open there. Regarding to Libya, it's quite risky, and we are not, we probably do not have the skills as churches to work in such a risky country. So I know that working in Libya would mean intercepting people who are about to leave, but it's too risky for a network of churches. We are not skilled enough to work there.
And I think the other two contributions were probably quite general, so if anyone wants to respond to either, or in whole or in part.
I'll refer to the question asked about the reticence to to acknowledge safe routes as a priority. Of course, that's not what we do, but we hear the excuse all the time that we only do what's possible. And there's this, it's not the motivation, but it's certainly the excuse used that states often, not just state actors, also non-state actors, hide behind this idea that, logistically impossible or ideologically impossible. And what organizations like the one sitting to my left do is prove that that is not true. So they open the door to say, well, how can you say that that's not a good idea or it's not possible? Because actually so-and-so's already done it, and didn't so many people already arrive through XYZ route? So I think, although that doesn't explain the motivation behind the reticence to engage with that kind of argument, it is breaking it down. Because now we can refer always, when we're in discussions with more powerful actors, to examples where safe routes organizations have had success. And it usually does start with smaller organizations and more grassroots organizations that really give us the first few case studies that then bigger organizations can draw on to attract funding or to attract public and political support. So I think a lot of the applause has to go to the organizations that really put the first foot forward, because they may not always be the best known or the biggest name, but they're the ones that allow that door to start to open a crack and the rest sort of to get their foot through it. So.
On that, I think that Europa is very hypocrite, because they protect the people who reach Europe. So that's a natural selection by money, by health, and by luck. And that's crazy, that's totally absurd. And what we hear from Belgian politicians, for example, is that, yes, but you understand, I would do that too with my children if Belgium was at war, like in Syria. But you know, if we accept more refugees in Europe, all the Europe will massively vote for extreme right-wing parties. That's what they say. So they say, we are afraid of that. But I think it's the opposite. They have to change the way people are seeing the refugees, and they have to take the lead. They are the bosses of our countries, and they that's a false reasoning for me, and that's an excuse. So I don't accept that.
All right, I promised I'd take another round of questions. We've got 9 minutes left. Okay. Over to you, team. Christina, would you like to start?
So I'll just address the two sort of more technical questions. In terms of the information disseminated to migrants before embarkation onto the vessels, the smuggling vessels in the countries of departure like Turkey and Libya, I'll focus on the central Mediterranean route, because as you said, it's a little more opaque, the system there. We do find that the communities themselves, there's quite a lot of conversation and interaction that goes on between people who have already done the crossing and people who are preparing to do the crossing, perhaps not in the immediate time frame. I think it's very difficult to get information in and out of Libya at the moment, but certainly at other points in the route they do share quite a lot of information with one another. But certainly one of the things that we look for, our organisation sits on the border between Libyan national water and international water. We have to wait for boats to drift into international water before we can take action. This is what I mean when I say on a more holistic approach. If there were appropriate actors for us to interact with on all the different portions of the route, you can then allow the route itself to become more transparent, and it can act as a warning, as advocacy on the conditions on the route. But yes, many people are aware more or less of the dangers involved, but you are right that there is a lot of misleading information disseminated, of course, by smugglers whose only priority is to get as many people onto their boat as possible. So they'll often, as you quite rightly said, provide a very fancy looking boat, get everybody on it, take everybody out beyond the horizon, and then transfer people onto a boat that's already sinking. We've had reports of boats that are that sink while transfers are happening. So say 5 or 6 rubber boats are transferring onto a big wooden boat, the boat goes down, you've got people in the water, and as they try and reboard the rubber boats that they were previously on, they're physically stopped from doing that by violence on behalf of the smugglers. It's this kind of, we have no jurisdiction to enter international water unless we know that there are people drowning. So if we're aware of an incident and we know that people are in the water, then we can enter. But if you don't have that information, you don't have the right to just patrol in national water. So it's that dissemination of information, I think, is what you've touched on, is hugely, hugely important. And in terms of what the future looks like, that's the million-dollar question. I can't speak to that. But for us, it's about engagement with different actors. And also, I think that there's actually, as people have touched on here, there are elements of the system that already exist, but we don't use them properly because there's not enough information and we don't know how to go about it, and the beneficiary community is expected to take the lead, as you said, with all this paperwork that's in a different language. And sort of everyone then goes and says, oh, but they can, you can do that, you can apply for a visa. But if you don't have the advocacy and the access to that information, then of course you might as well not be able to. So I think it's also about making the system more transparent and that information more accessible to the communities that need to use it. So really simple things like translations and legal advocacy can make a huge difference in beneficiary communities. I don't know what the end picture looks like, but I think it will require a lot more interaction between the intervening actors, but also the dissemination of information and the advocacy for beneficiaries to use the systems already available also.
Julia.
Yeah, answering to the third down there, I completely agree. There is, you were telling, a person in need of protection should receive protection no matter of the nationality. And I completely agree. I mean, there is this tendency at European level and at national level. But by the way, Europe is made by single states, so it's our country made Europe, so it's two level, but they are more or less the same. There is this tendency to recognize easily the protection to people coming from escaping from Syria, but it's much more difficult to recognize protection, to give protection from people coming from Africa, for instance. And during our work, for instance, for us was very, very easy, opening the corridor from Lebanon for people escaping from Syria, but it was much harder working on the other corridors from Morocco and Ethiopia because the beneficiaries come from Africa. So I completely agree with you. There is now this tendency that to consider the real true refugees only Syrians, while it's not so. And legally speaking, actually, Syrians should be entitled to subsidiary protection because they are fleeing a war and not necessary persecution based on the grounds of the Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a point, definitely. Then the question on private sponsorship, maybe the okay
sponsorship scheme.
Okay, yeah, more or less it's similar. Your program is based also on Article.
Oh, we just tried to make one with our own hands, almost, because it didn't exist in Belgium. So we started from the humanitarian visa, which exists in the law,
yeah,
but without any condition.
Huge, yeah.
It's like it's very vague. And then we tried to build our file on basis of the medical condition of the children and the security problems in Syria and everything. And so we just did it, but there was no clear guidelines for that. But we, for example, we had an appointment with UNHCR. They wanted to meet us in Belgium because they were interested by what we did. And they gave us examples of programs of private sponsorship abroad, around the world. and inviting us almost to try to conceive such a program for Belgium. But we are citizens, so it's quite difficult, but we are working on that. That's what I said now with academics. And so we are, I hope it will work. But then you have conditions, you have to collect a certain amount of money, and then if you reach all the conditions, if you fulfill all the conditions, then you have quite a right to make people come with a visa on a legal way, and it exists in America, Canada, Germany also, I think, Ireland, and I heard yeah, maybe.
So, yes.
Okay, so fantastic. The amount, it depends. There, in some programs, you only have to pay for the flight tickets, and then the state does all the rest. And in other programs, you have to take the engagement to take care of the people during the 3 first years in the country. So they are not in charge of the state and the social security. It's different in every country, actually. So it's a negotiation, I think, sure, with the authorities.
Okay. We need to wrap up, I'm afraid. This has been extremely interesting. I'm sure all the speakers are willing to be approached and to continue the conversation at the break. Hassan, would you like the last word?
Me.
Yes. Or indeed, Jose?
Je dois ajouter quelque chose en plus de la protection donc et couloir humanitaire pour les réfugiés. Il y a des gens qui méritent d'être venus ici et d'être soignés et qui sont encore bloqués en Syrie dans la totale insécurité. Il n'y a pas du tout. Ce sont les femmes veuves et leurs enfants. Ils ne peuvent pas se déplacer, ils ne peuvent pas bouger. Elles sont tout le temps menacées. Et ces gens méritent aussi d'être aidés. Nous avons tout le temps des appels pour qu'elles puissent traverser et venir, et surtout celles qui ont des enfants malades. Si tu veux bien traduire.
No, he said the most vulnerable people are still in Syria, and especially the single mother with who lost their husband with small children. And we have a case of a mother; she lost her eye and she's still alone with 3 children, and it's awful, and she is not protected in Syria, actually, so it's very difficult.
Okay, before we thank all of our speakers one more time, for it was an excellent presentation. Unless you have anything you want to throw in? No? Okay then. We're going to thank them all in 1 second. We're about to have a break, and we're going to be back in here at 3, and it's going to be incredibly exciting, and everyone's going to be really punctual, unlike me, right? So thank you all.